Hello and welcome to the Leaders Council podcast with me, Scott Challoner. This podcast, just like the Leaders Council itself, is all about recognising and celebrating the people who keep this country running. We exist to give leaders a voice outside of their own organisation and to support them in the same way that they support their staff every single day of the week. Now, if you are in a leadership position yourself and would like to have your voice heard on the national stage, then please do go to leaderscouncil.co.uk/apply. Now, joining me on today's programme on what is a cloudy May morning here in the capital is Daniel Crouch. Daniel is a partner at Daniel Crouch Rare Books, a specialist dealer in antique atlases, maps, plans, sea charts and voyages dating from the 15th to the 19th centuries. Daniel is also the treasurer of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association and chair of Wolvecote Cricket Club in North Oxford. Daniel, very warm welcome to yourself today and thank you ever so much for taking the time to join us on the show.
Hi, good morning.
It's a real pleasure welcoming you on, Daniel. I think a good place to start would be by addressing the elephant in the room here, and that's the fact that we are still in the grip of the COVID-19 global pandemic, and we have been for the best part of 14 months. And given you work in quite a niche industry, I was wondering to what extent this whole thing has affected you and your business.
Well, obviously, as the very definition of a non-essential business, we were closed for a large part of both 2020 and early 2021. And we have a shop. We had two shops, one in New York and one in London. And we didn't really do anything in terms of retail business for most of that time. However, all things have worked out better than I had expected this time last year. And although we've had to close the New York business, mainly because the Upper East Side of New York was no longer the place that it was in 2019, we've found that we've come through this and we've managed to keep everybody employed, which is the main thing that we intended to do at the beginning.
That's brilliant to hear. Really, really encouraging stuff. And just going back to sort of the early days of the crisis, of course, it's good now looking back that you've kept everybody in a job, but I can imagine that you were having to sort of wrangle with some real anxiety at the very beginning of this, and that might have been quite a tricky experience.
Yeah, I mean, the very, very beginning was particularly defined. We were in Maastricht at the European Fine Art Fair, a huge trade show in the Netherlands, and about 25 people were diagnosed with COVID as a direct result of that fair, including two of my colleagues who were out there with me. And I drove back with them, instantly put myself into isolation and waited to get sick, and then wasn't, although it turned out I would appear to have been asymptomatic. And then really from the middle of March, right the way through till end of August, it was like someone just turned off the tap. I mean, there was no business. We did very little. With the exception of one customer who very generously phoned up and said, I guess you guys could do with me buying something right now. And that really saw us through. And then, come September, suddenly people realized there was a way out and things started picking up. And I think that a lot of collectors of rare maps and books were at home with more time on their hands, and obviously things are doing quite well for them as well in terms of stocks and shares and investments. And so our business picked up. But certainly those first 4 months, I had this lot of sleepless nights and this little list of employees and who and how we'd have to lose people if things got really bad. And one that terrified me all the time is we have one member of staff who's in the UK on a expert visa. And so if she lost her job with us, she would technically be deported along with her boyfriend.
Goodness, that's quite something, isn't it? And just thinking about sort of the last sort of 14 months as a whole then, I understand that you've been sort of inactive for quite large periods of that up until the September just gone in 2020. But would you say that maybe the experience of managing the company through this crisis has perhaps taught you anything new at all?
Yeah, an enormous amount. I mean, certainly the main thing is that my colleagues work at least as well, if not better, without me and my partner Nick in the shop. We are able to all do a lot more remotely than we thought. And that's given a whole new quality of life to a lot of people, as people spend more time at home, some time in the office, obviously, because we do deal with staff and people. But it has given us a new view on what we do in the year. And I used to travel all around the world and do 15 shows every year. And perhaps we've seen that that's not as important as we thought it was.
That certainly makes sense. And thinking about sort of the experience that you've had sort of a little bit more broadly in terms of mentality and psychology as well, would you say that you've emerged from this stronger and maybe more aware than you were maybe sort of 12 to 14 months ago?
Yes, certainly in a sort of happier place, weirdly. I mean, I think the fact that we've kept employed has obviously buoyed us all enormously. And we are financially stronger. And we've realised that the shop in New York was an expensive luxury, and one we can definitely do without. And I would say that the quality of life has improved, and business has stayed steady.
And quality of life and the work-life balance is something that's really come under the microscope during the pandemic, isn't it? And as a result of that, I think we're going to see the way that we do business, not just in the UK, but in the world at large, much changed as a result of the pandemic, aren't we? Of course, there's only so much scope that your business has to sort of change its way of operating, but that is something that we're going to see, isn't it, do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still obviously a huge importance to in-person events and you know, as I say, ideally in stuff, I have to go and see it and people have to come and see it. And I meet customers all around the world who don't necessarily know about the sort of material that we have until they encounter it. And so it's important we do get out and about. But perhaps there'll be fewer and better quality events and fewer air miles in doing so. And the main change in quality of life is that everybody now who works for Dana Crouch Rare Books has at least one day in the week where they can work from home.
Yes, absolutely. And that's very, very good for people to sort of have that work-life balance in place. And thinking, of course, about sort of leadership figures now in a bit more detail in that context, do you sort of find it easy to sort of step away from the business, take a step back when you need to, and sort of switch off and recharge the batteries as a result of this as well?
No, I'm terrible at that. because we work in all time zones, the business follows me all through the day. As you mentioned earlier, I do play cricket, and getting out on a cricket field and playing with a Walker Cricket Club is the way I turn off.
And there's been a real emphasis on that as well, isn't there? Given, of course, the sort of health risks associated with sort of being unhealthy and COVID-19, I think there's going to be a real campaign for people to go out and play more sport as and when they're able to. Restrictions have been lifting. People have been allowed to go and do that in groups now. So that's something we might hopefully see in earnest a little bit more over the coming weeks and months.
Absolutely. Well, the cricket season's in full swing despite the weather now. And certainly last year, it was an enormous relief to be able, as soon as we were able to get out and play and practice and see each other. And because it's an outside activity, it's pretty COVID safe. And we've been practicing, you know, COVID safe policies on the pitch. And so far, no one's got ill. And it's really good to get out and get some exercise and see the guys.
Yes, I can imagine so. And just thinking about sort of working practices again for a moment there, of course, you mentioned that the business is really accustomed to working within all time zones. So I suppose when it comes to sort of remote contact, you were maybe a little bit ahead of the curve, weren't you? And it's maybe been a little bit easier to adapt in that sense to sort of those demands.
Yes, although we hadn't quite embraced video technology in the way we have now. I mean, Nick and I and everyone at the shop has been recording some small videos related to some of our books, which you can see on our website. And we've been doing a lot of sort of Zoom viewings with customers. And that was something I'd never really got my head around before. And it's been really, really useful and rather successful. I had a meeting in Australia last week that was almost like having them in the shop.
That's quite, it's quite incredible, isn't it, what technology is capable of? But I suppose there's always an element of it that has to sort of remain for the in-person experience. So that's something that is still going to be important. People talk about sort of the changing retail environment especially, but I think there is still going to be a place for that because people have been keen, haven't they, since non-essential retail has returned to sort of flock back to sort of their local high streets and other settings.
Yeah, we don't. That's actually one area that hasn't come back at all for us. I mean, central London Mayfair is pretty dead. And certainly a lot of our walking trade, which was not a very large part of our business, but it was an important part of our business, A lot of that has dropped off because fewer and fewer people are visiting London on business or leisure and dropping in. And I think what will change in the future is obviously we need to have bricks and mortar present somewhere and people need to come and see the books and maps. But it may be that people are coming to London once a year rather than three times a year. And that's something we have to adapt and deal with. And that will probably be reflected in rates and rents in the central town. Mm.
But of course, when it comes to adapting in that sense, we've seen innovation on an unprecedented scale from industry over the last 14 months. And I think industry, therefore, is in a good place to continue to change for whatever state the world is going to be in.
Yes, and certainly it's sharpened everybody up in terms of their online practices and ability to become a bit more flexible with working practices and how we meet and talk to clients.
It certainly has, hasn't it? And quite often as well, I tend to discuss sort of how mentally taxing it is for business executives trying to lead their companies through such a difficult situation. And we often hear that phrase that it's lonely at the top and people are constantly looking to our leaders in business for that inspiration, for that reassurance. But when you are the one at the top of the tree, where is it that you sort of draw your inspiration and your own motivation from to sort of keep going at a time of crisis?
It's a pretty small tree in my position. One looks to people who taught on things as the years have gone on. So in previous employers, I certainly think, what would they have done? My colleagues in the trade. I'm very lucky to work in a very collegiate environment, and other book dealers are friends as well as colleagues, and we often share our problems and our successes, and that's been really important. And still getting together, albeit on Zoom rather than in restaurants, but still talking to friends and colleagues in the last year has been helpful. But also, more important than that, my family, my wife, my kids.
And I think having that support network, that key word there, network, is incredibly important. And also for some younger viewers that may be tuning into this podcast and thinking about starting business for themselves, networking and speaking to other business leaders, particularly those doing the same thing as them, it's one of the best things that you can do, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the smartest things I've ever done in my life, aside from my lovely wife, was agree to go into business with a partner rather than try and be a sole trader on my own, because it's really important to share one's anxieties and jokes with a friend. And certainly that's been absolutely beneficial during this last couple of years as well.
And maybe going back to the start of the business, of course, you say you're relieved that you went into business with a partner, but is there anything that you'd maybe do differently armed with the knowledge that you have now?
I was asked about this in an interview recently. I came up with a instinctive reaction. Yes, I'd campaign more to keep us in the EU.
Yes, of course, because I don't think in some ways we really felt the full impact of Brexit, have we? Because the economy's been shut down for such a large part of the year so far, albeit we're starting to see things returning and we've seen an impact in some certainly export industries. But I suppose the full pinch and the full effects aren't really going to be felt for quite some time yet. And then it's going to become clear as to, reflecting on leaving the European Union, whether or not it was indeed a good idea.
Well, I'm a very international facing business and we export a lot. It's been, an unmitigated disaster. There is absolutely no upside whatsoever. We have been hit by having to pay, the books are zero rated for VAT. And so where we had a zero rated advantage into the whole of the European market, we have been hit with separate VAT rates to import into each and every European country, which has had a huge effect on our ability to be competitive, but also just a hassle factor for clients. And then the main thing where I think the government has singularly failed to get anything right is the way the shipping companies and the customs are liaising with clients, because it's a real mess. Things are coming in late. They are getting inappropriate fees levied on them. And it just is very, very sticky. It is definitely not a friction-free border.
It's not. And funnily enough, back in January, I was actually speaking on the programme to a gentleman who runs a shellfish company in the west of Scotland. And because they specialise, of course, in the export of live produce, the barriers that they've had have been absolutely staggering. So it's certainly, you're not alone in that sense. There are a lot of businesses with similar complaints, and they're having to, of course, work longer hours and also have more costs levied upon them, as you say, because they're having to employ more people to get all of the paperwork done as well, because the administrative burden is just as big, of course, as the logistical one.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, my shippers are finding it all much, much harder. We use a brilliant firm called Art Logistics. And it's just, you know, shipping costs have almost doubled. And I've taken to, in order to try and work around the obstacles, I'm looking to register for VAT in Ireland, which is, you know, a completely unnecessary and slightly insane way of routing my sales through Ireland in order to get into the EU. And other companies I know are being advised to open European offices, which can't be good in terms of efficiency, and it's certainly not very good for the environment.
It's certainly also not good for taking business out of the UK as well, and that was, of course, one of the central pillars of the whole Brexit project. So we'll certainly see over the coming years what will come of that. But just before we do wrap things up, Daniel, because I am conscious that we are running short of time, over the next sort of 12 months, and of course, this isn't just in relation to COVID, it is also in relation to the Brexit conundrum. Where are you hoping really for the business to be within a year from now?
Well, it's a fascinating time. I suspect that we will be doing more direct sales online. And I would like to see in a year's time, allied to that, a return of in-person events and travel, but with a much more concentrated effort on a few key events, and to continue my new rather relaxed life of spending more time at home with the family and playing cricket.
And that's some of the most important things that, of course, you can do, sort of have that time away from sort of the hectic business world, step aside, make some time for yourself, because it is so important for that work-life balance, for that mental health that we've spoken about so much during this conversation. And I have to say, Daniel, it's been a very eye-opening experience for myself and also for the listeners, just understanding a bit more about what's going on within the industry at this point in time. And as we really start to see over the next few months and years, more of a clear picture as to what the impact is ultimately going to be of leaving the European Union, of the COVID-19 aftermath, I think it would be great to welcome you onto the show again to just catch up on goings on within the business and also what shape the industry at large is taking to.
You'd be delighted to.
It would be my pleasure as well, Daniel. Again, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. And most importantly, please do take care and stay safe with all still going on in the world as well, because we're almost there, but we're not quite out of the woods yet.
Magic. Thank you very much indeed.
It was a pleasure to speak to Daniel Crouch on today's programme. And next up on the show, we'll be joined by former England cricket captain Sir Andrew Strauss, who during his playing days became one of only three England captains to secure the Ashes both at home and away in Australia, as well as racking up the second highest number of test victories for an England skipper in history. That will be coming up now.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jonathan White, and today we are joined by Sir Andrew Strauss, former captain of the England cricket team and former director of cricket at the ECB. Sir Andrew, thank you very much for joining us today.
Real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
The pleasure is all of ours. You know, Andrew, you've had a distinguished career, as I said, both on and off the pitch in English cricket, recognised not least with your knighthood for services to sport. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, there have been ups and downs in the career, like any career, including public and private disagreements with certain individuals. And on that front, I think what everybody wants to know, have you finally forgiven Marcus Trescothick for giving you that stupid Lord Brockett nickname?
Well, my recollection was that it wasn't Marcus Trescothick who gave me that nickname. It was actually Mark Butcher.
He's to blame.
You know, I think there were a lot of people. It was the senior England teams at the at that time who wanted to sort of put me in my place and make sure that I didn't get above my station. So thankfully, it didn't particularly stick, other than within those group of players.
And you really did try and get on their nerves by getting above your station, because, of course, in your first outing, you went on to score 112. Mm. Now, am I right in saying this, perhaps, that you only got there because Michael Vaughan did himself an injury?
Well, that was the reason I got on the pitch in the first place. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's often sort of misunderstood or misjudged the role that luck plays in an international career or sporting career, full stop. And, you know, I was waiting patiently in the wings for an opportunity, and it didn't really seem like an opportunity was going to come along. And then, you know, I've only got injured in the nets, and there was my chance, and I had to kind of grab it with both hands if I could.
And you certainly did. What was it like then to see your name being put up on the Lord's Honour Board after your first appearance?
Yeah, look, I'd just been transported to a completely different world almost. I was a Middlesex player, I was captain of Middlesex, all my focus was on helping Middlesex sort of win the championship and whatever. And then a week later, I've scored a test century, which is something I'd always dreamed out, you know, literally all my life. And then the thought of doing it at Lord's in your first test match. I mean, it was literally the dream. So, and then suddenly I started thinking, wow, hold on, potentially I've got a whole England career ahead of me and everything that entails. So it was a real shock to the system. But I suppose what I was grateful for was that I was relatively old, probably not the right way of putting it, but I was 27 years of age. I was pretty comfortable with my own game. And I was also, I think, mature enough to understand that this was a great opportunity for me, but not to get carried away with it, which is unfortunately what happens with a lot of younger players.
Without a doubt. And I think in those early years of your career, it's so important, I think you'd agree, especially when you're learning from other more experienced people. And this can be true of any field, whether it's sports or politics or business, to have somebody there that you can rely on or look up to for guidance. In those early days, was there somebody that you could say to this day that, thank goodness they were there for you?
Well, I think in preparing me for international cricket, Justin Langer was a massive source of advice for me. So he was captain of Middlesex a couple of years beforehand and really helped me understand what I needed to do to get there. But then I think on the day-to-day basis, my wife Ruth played a huge role, you know, and just in terms of, because I think there is that real danger that you get carried away with it and you think international sport in that goldfish bowl that, you know, you're more important than you were previously, or that whole world is the real world. And obviously all we know is that the real world, nothing's changed other than other people's perception of you.
And you need that grounding. And again, that can be true of so many different areas of life.
I think so, yeah. I mean, very easy to get caught up in it and end up doing different things, being with different people, sort of trying to enjoy everything that goes with international cricket rather than focusing on the actual international cricket.
And in those early days, Andrew, there were lots of examples where you could have got carried away because that team accomplished so much. I think for a lot of people, the 2005 Ashes series is one of the greatest sporting moments of this country's history. Now, we could chat for hours about that, but I know I wouldn't be allowed to, and you've got other places to be, so we can't do that. But if I may, I would love to ask what your highlight was personally for that. But perhaps more importantly, as a team, how were you able as a group to deal with the pressure no doubt you were feeling?
Yeah, well, the pressure is like nothing else that I experienced before or after, because, you know, I think it's easy to forget how much of a holy grail the Ashes was back then. You know, we hadn't won it for so long and it seemed like we'd come up against these invincible Australian teams year after year. So, you know, the closer we got to it, the harder it became. I remember Ashley Giles walking into the dressing room for the final day of the series, and I looked at him and he looked absolutely terrible, like just white of a sheet, grey. He looked like aged about 5 years. I went, God, Charlie, you're not looking too good. And he went, yeah, it's not surprising. I haven't slept for 8 weeks. And I went, well, join the club. You know, and I think we'd all been sort of living this behind our own closed doors. And it's just an extraordinary thing. And without doubt, the highlight was number one, drawing that game at the Oval to make sure we won the Ashes, but also the day after, you know, that open top bus parade around London, and to understand that we'd broken out of the cricket bubble, that they're just general sports fans or just people that were interested in seeing England win at something were all engaged and completely besotted by the whole thing.
I think that's such a key point, Andrew, because there were so many people back in 2005 that may have not even given cricket a second glance, and it put a whole new generation, especially of children, school kids, into loving that sport. And so beyond the actual competition itself, what a fantastic thing to be able to say was accomplished for
absolutely everything you say there is absolutely right. Like we just sort of opened the doors of cricket to a whole new generation. But probably more importantly, it was the one and only time in my life that I got papped outside a nightclub that night when we were celebrating. You know, I felt like I'd really arrived as a celebrity. Yes. It only happened for that one night, unfortunately.
But I did ask for a highlight, and if you didn't perhaps give a specific one on the pitch. So I would suggest perhaps that catch at Trent Bridge.
No. I mean, the catch at Trent Bridge was, you see a ball, you stick out your hand and it goes in. I think my personal highlight was I scored 100 in that fifth test match under real pressure. And that was one that, you know, that wasn't a moment. That was a number of hours and I had to dig pretty deep to do that.
Now, obviously, not that long later, and you were lucky enough and the privilege, I'm sure, no doubt, to serve as captain. And whether you like it or not, you become the focal point of criticism. You were looked on, up to, and relied upon to be strong, especially when the going gets tough. You become a leader in many senses of the word. During your time as captain, what qualities does one require to fulfill that role?
Well, a fair amount of resilience for starters. You know, you're absolutely right. I remember when I got the role, it did feel like the biggest sort of poison chalice of all time, and sort of a litany of England captains had sort of been churned up by the job prior to me taking over. So there was that sort of realization: this is going to be a tough thing to do, and you're going to have to dig pretty deep. But I think actually, the most important thing was sort of just pushing all that noise to one side and just clarifying, okay, if I'm going to do this job, what is it that we really want to achieve out of this? Mm. And so suddenly that becomes a bit more exciting and a bit more enticing, the idea of, well, we can do something that's never been done before here and I've got the opportunity to play my part in that. So, I think that was a big part of it for me. I think a lot of those qualities around leadership, I don't think you know you have them until you're in that situation. Absolutely. And it's very hard to prepare yourself properly for those sort of situations.
And when managing a team, you're required to manage, of course, what some people could call big personalities. Others could use different, shorter words. How poisonous can it be, when players, and indeed, and this applies again to so many different areas of life, when individuals think they are perhaps more important than a team?
Well, I think probably worth broadening out that a bit. I think there are all sorts of different people that you have to sort of contend with in a team environment. And the job of the leadership or the management is to try and sort of gel them all together and get them bought into what you're trying to do and whatever. So, there are some people that are a bit more self-absorbed. There's some people that are slightly more maverick in the way they view the world. There's some people that are very quiet. There's some people that are, perhaps very worried about what might go wrong. And so you've got to try and understand all these people individually and try and get the best out of them. There was definitely a line there for me in terms of embracing difference up to the point where someone following their agenda was going in a completely different path from the team's agenda. And, if and when that happens, that should be a problem for a leadership. And if it isn't a problem, then you're not doing your job properly.
Absolutely. And with all that in mind, actually, and perhaps this is a bit of a mean question, but what advice would you give to others in a similar position, leading a team, being looked up to? What would be the key advice you'd give to them? And that you couldn't really do without it.
Just generally about leading
a
team.
I think so.
Okay.
Yes.
Number one thing about leadership, I'm absolutely certain about this, is that the people you're leading need to know that you care about them. Mm. And if they genuinely believe you've got their best interests at heart, they will forgive all sorts of other inadequacies you might have. And I definitely had many. Because they'll know your heart's in the right place and they'll feel comforted. There'll be a degree of sort of psychological safety or whatever you might term to make sure that the team comes together when the going gets tough. If they genuinely don't believe you care about them and you're in it for yourself, doesn't matter how charismatic you might be. It doesn't matter, you know, how gregarious and how impressive you might be as a person. They will be wary of you and they will start looking after their own interests very quickly.
Now, in 2015, obviously, you were appointed as director of cricket at the ECB. You took some pretty major steps early on. You brought in Trevor Bayliss as coach, was brought in. You put a much greater emphasis on limited overs cricket. Now, in the abstract, what had you identified that needed to be changed for English cricket? And were there qualities that you had developed, you'd found out you had as England captain, that you were able to bring over to the job?
Okay, so the first thing was, we had this unbelievable opportunity of the World Cup on home soil in 2019. I was sick and tired of watching us make the same mistakes in World Cups, and this includes my time as captain. We just kept on sleepwalking our way into it and pretending everything would be on the all right on the night, and it never was. And so I definitely made it our priority to win that 2019 World Cup. I thought that was more important than anything else that was going to be taking place in my tenure. And I knew in order to do that, we had to completely shift our perception of white ball cricket.
Quite a radical shift from what we were coming from.
Yeah, but the rest of the game had moved on. And the rest of the game had understood that white ball cricket was playing an increasingly important role in both financially, but also in terms of players' focus and interest. Yes. And we had to move. In fact, we didn't have to move as times. We need to get ahead of the time. So, you know, we had to completely shift out both our philosophy, but also the way we played in order to do that. And I was very lucky having both Trevor Bayliss and Owen Morgan, who were prepared to sort of role model that and lead that through. And the second part of your question around what had the England captaincy sort of done to prepare me for the role, I think I was comfortable leading. I knew the environment. I knew what I was getting myself into. And in the early days, I could leverage some of the relationships that I had with the players. But actually, I found it a very different challenge because you are so far removed from what's going on the ground. Right. And so, you know, you're relying on other people to have to, you know, buy into what you want to happen and then do it themselves. Mm. And often, you know, in different time zones in different parts of the world. So that was a very new experience for me.
Well, I think the strategy paid off. And I don't know about you, but when watching that World Cup final, again, as so many people did in this country, it's once again inspired another generation of especially school kids who, again, might not have given cricket a second look, who have now become avid cricket fans. I know of some, what a wonderful thing that must be.
Yeah, it was an incredible day, wasn't it? I mean, I think in our vision, like when we're talking about the opportunity of winning the 2019 World Cup, I had this vision in my mind of Lords on a sunny day and a close finish and the incredible kind of, you know, emotion that went with it. No one could have dreamt how it played out. I've never seen a game of cricket like that in my whole life, and for it to be the World Cup final was quite extraordinary.
I know some fantastically avid cricket fans who were Googling there and then what exactly the rules became, because
absolutely.
Now, Andrew, in your wife's memory, you established the Ruth Strauss Foundation last year. In doing so, whether you'd admit it or not, yourself and the foundation has become an inspiration to thousands, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, sons and daughters. Please do take some time, if you wouldn't mind, and you to explain to the listeners the work the foundation does and what it's been like to lead a project like that.
Yeah, thanks. Well, look, I mean, we obviously had a very tough journey as a family. First of all, Ruth being diagnosed, Ruth was someone that was always well. You never think she was going to be someone that was sort of laid down by cancer. And for us to find out that she had lung cancer was extraordinary. She'd never smoked a cigarette in her life. And I think we all had this perception of lung cancer being a smoker's disease.
Absolutely.
And so just having gone through the experience and obviously some very low times and us coming to terms with the fact that Ruth had stage 4 cancer and she was going to die, we learned a lot in that process. And thankfully, we had time for me to speak to Ruth before she died about legacy and what we could do to make something positive come out of, you know, this experience we'd all been through. And so after she died, in December 2018, I came back and launched the foundation with two focuses. Number one, to fund research into these rare forms of lung cancer. These are the non-smoking lung cancers. 5,000 to 7,000 people each year in this country are diagnosed with these. No one knows why they're getting them, but they're on the increase, and it's women, young women, that are affected more than men.
Extraordinary numbers.
Yeah, I mean, in the list of top 10 cancers, it's number 8. Rare forms of lung cancer, number 8. So it's not really rare, it's probably a misnomer, but it's, we're really lacking in funding and understanding. And then the second element, and probably this is in some ways more pressing, is to help cancer, anyone who's got cancer who has an incurable diagnosis, to help them and their families prepare themselves for death. Mm. And so in order to do that, we need to be able to find ways of them having open conversations with each other, because if you do this well, it should help the bereavement afterwards if you're well prepared for it. It's not something people like to do. I was very lucky that Ruth wanted to do it. But also we have to have that debate about the taboo of death and, you know, effectively how uncomfortable we are talking about it, and certainly how bad we are preparing for it. If you think for a moment about antenatal classes before you have your baby, like how we're preparing you for how your life's going to change, and we do nothing around death, even though we're all going to experience it in one shape or form. And, I think as a society, we need to be better than that. We've come a long way in so many different areas, and especially around mental health. And we can do better about death. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I think the foundation is leading the way in breaking taboos on that front, because they need to be broken. I know they've got, the foundation is going at some events there. So if you could tell us about some of those, that would be.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of big ones. So the Westminster Mile, which is a very inclusive. If you're thinking about, think about a marathon, but just think about just doing a mile of a marathon rather than 26.
Sounds ideal.
So we've got grandparents, we've got little kids, we've got people pushing prams, so that we're going to get as many people as possible to play their part in that and raise some funds. We've got the Red for Ruth Day at Lourdes again. So that was an incredible day for us.
Whether you were there or not, especially if you were there, I mean to say, but whether it was the photos in the papers the next day, what an extraordinary, I think it was the 15th of April, wasn't it? What an extraordinary day, and what an overwhelming day that must have been for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, an Ashes test match is a big day anyway. Yes. And then for us to have that extra element of the Red for Ruth Day, and to see the wave of support, you know, myself and the boys were incredibly profoundly affected by that in a good way. You know, we felt so much love and support there. And then the foundation is directly benefited hugely by the funds raised. And we want to take it up a gear and make it more of a community thing, not just the day at Lourdes.
I even saw some of the stuffiest members of the MCC, Andrew, wearing red. So what an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, well, a lot of them wear red trousers anyway, I think. But absolutely. You know, they were right behind us. And, you know, we really want that to be something that's embedded in the English summer, just like the McGrath Foundation days. Yes. in Sydney in Australia.
Well, it's been a complete inspiration, and I very much hope we can talk about that perhaps late in a few months as well.
Absolutely.
Before we go, as I'm conscious of the time, it's also an exciting year for domestic cricket, not least because of the introduction of the 100, not without its critics, though, I should. Andrew, I know you're a big proponent of it. The Blast has clearly shown that the short form of the game has brought cricket to a new and growing audience, exciting games. What do you say to those that ask, why do we need the 100 as well?
So the 100 is the most important step forward in domestic cricket in this country ever. And the reason for that is that increasingly, there's two things. First of all, we need to break out of the cricket bubble. So the Blast followers tend to be the same people that follow other cricket.
Right.
And therefore, you know, that's a small audience, mm-hmm. and potentially a declining one over time, even though the Blast sales are increasing. We need to break out of that and try and get more general sports fans into cricket. But more importantly, just the way the tournament's set up, and it's one game a day over a 6-week period, broadcasters will pay money for that. And therefore, what we're trying to do is reduce our reliance on international cricket paying all the bills. If you think about Test cricket and some of the issues around the world, we just can't rely on that money coming in to fund the game. So we need to find another way of doing that. I just think it's going to be an incredible success. I'm so excited about it. I know there are people that are worried about it, but in 2 or 3 years' time, you know, we're going to have our own short-form tournament that will rival the Big Bash, and we'll be moving towards the IPL. And those are, yeah, those are two enormous events out there, and we can have our own version of that ourselves.
I can feel your enthusiasm for it. As a as an Essex fan, I'm still stumped as to, I think I'm going to have to choose between either supporting a team based at the Oval or a team based at Lords. And I'll get over that, but I'll have to do
well,
it.
Well, surely it's going to be the Lords one, right?
Of course. Yeah. Sanju, it's been an absolute pleasure discussing that and everything else with you today. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
This has been the Leaders Council podcast. Thank you for celebrating excellence in leadership with us. I've been your host, Scott Challoner. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast. The views expressed within the podcast do not reflect the views of the Leaders Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, its parent company or subsidiaries, members of staff, or other guests of any other person therein associated.